Listen up. I know you're a fan of neuroscience. You're listening to this podcast. I can bet that, you think neuroscience is kind of cool. Well, let me tell you, if you are a fan of neuroscience and if you are a fan of this podcast, you should come here. We are having something called Sunposium. It's March 4th through 6th, and it is in beautiful West Palm Beach, Florida. This is a two-day conference. It brings the best minds in neuroscience, some real high-profile people that you do not want to miss. There's going to be poster sessions, and there's going to be a chance to meet the podcast team if you want to do that. We'd love to meet you. We love our listeners. We're now accepting abstracts, and the most exciting submissions will have the opportunity to speak at Sunposium. You can learn more at sunposium.org. That's S-U-N, as in sunny Florida. Sunposium.org in West Palm Beach. It's a wonderful place. Where you are is probably cold in March, so come join us.
Welcome to Max Planck Florida Institute's Neurotransmissions Podcast. Today, Drs. Joe Schumacher and Ben Scholl are joined by Dr. Judith Hirsch, Professor of Biological Sciences at the University of Southern California, and Dr. Fritz Sommer, Adjunct Professor at the Redwood Center for Theoretical Neuroscience and Helen Willis Neuroscience Institute at the University of California, Berkeley, and faculty member in the Department of Computer Science at the University of Ulm.
Today we're joined by Dr. Judith Hirsch. She's a professor in the Departments of Biological Sciences and Neurobiology,
Actually, it's one department, and it's a section within a larger department. It's kind of like biological sciences. You can think of a federation. And then neurobiology is one of the states in that federation.
We're also joined by Dr. Fritz Sommer. Sommer. He's an adjunct professor at the Redwood Center for Theoretical Neuroscience, where he served as acting director in 2009, and the Helen Wills Neuroscience Institute at UC Berkeley. You also have a faculty appointment at the University of Ulm, is that right, in Germany?
Right. Mm-hmm.
In computer science.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this is actually a first for our podcast. We've had a husband and wife on the podcast, but not at the same time. So this is the first time we've had a real honest-to-goodness neuroscience power couple in the flesh and blood. But we thought it would maybe be an interesting...
You didn't know we were a power couple, did you?
Yes, I know this for the first time.
Yeah, we don't experience that, but Thank you. That's so thoughtful and misguided.
Well, I mean, thoughtful and misguided is like kind of my MO, I think.
Okay,
so.
Well, then we have a lot in common, although I don't know how thoughtful I am.
But you both are neuroscientists who tackle neuroscience questions from two pretty different perspectives. Judith, you're a classic experimentalist using whole cell techniques, and you're a computational neuroscience person. And you have a wide variety of interests, it seems like, based on your publication record. So I'm a little bit curious, what is the sort of academic dynamic like between the two of you? How do you decide that, you have something that benefits your physiology experiments or you need some computational expertise? Like, how does that collaboration sort of work?
Well, I would say, the good thing, of course, is that our expertise is quite orthogonal of each other. So, whenever there are some natural questions, for example, how computations in, sensory areas are performed and kind of go, really from the biology and the physiology all the way to the computation. And this is kind of this interface where we actually then have a collaboration.
I think there was a personal reason. We applied for jobs together for years and never found them. And so when we work together, Fritz can come down and co-supervise the students. So that's nice for us. I think it's both our personalities. We're both somewhat curious. I think it's also happenstance. My first advisor was an engineer. So I got used to working with people with an engineering bent. And it makes me approach experiments differently. And I think that that's good. So I worked with an engineer, and then I had to leave labs for, you know, women in science reasons, and switched to another lab. I missed working with the engineer. He was not the problem. I really liked that. I was in a department full of engineers. Then I moved to Rockefeller and started to collaborate with Clay Reed, who was computational. And I like the way it forces me to think as a biologist, because I think biologists have to be very intuitive. And I think biologists have ideas to do something that come from some mysterious place and see things and start to see patterns emerge and so on and so forth. But it's hard to know how much of that is outside of one's own head and how much of that is inside of one's own head. And it's very nice working with someone who can help quantify observations. But again, one wants to quantify things that haven't been seen before, and so there have to be new ways to come up with how to think to quantify something, so that's useful. And then also you can only think so deeply, right? And in my case, not that deeply. If you work with someone who's able to theorists think in a different way, it can be frustrating, right? Because they're going to reduce things down to, they're going to choose certain elements to focus on, which may not be the ones you choose or think that are important. But I think you end up, if you get a good collaboration going, with a kind of dynamical collaboration. So you start to view your things a little bit differently given the theorist's context, and change your experiments, learn how to change the design a little bit so that you can actually analyze what you pull out of the animal. And then I think there are all sorts of things, kind of like doing experiments, you get better at them and you don't know why. I think in the collaboration, you get better at collaborating and you don't know why. We probably have a shorthand that we can use to talk to each other with. We'll probably work harder for each other than one might work for someone else. And I always say it gives you something to fight about that's not personal.
where does a specific question evolve from or emerge? Does it sort of a given experiment that you decide to do come from the two of you, from a discussion, or is it Judith, something that you've been wanting to do something and you've been thinking a while, and then you just start doing it, and then you get sort of guidance, or the experiment gets honed in into different details? Or is it really just...
It's all of those.
All of those things.
I think it's all of those. I mean, one project that didn't involve Fritz actually is I like Ken Miller a lot, and I was talking to Ken Miller, and I found two kinds of inhibitory cells in LAIR-4 in the cat. It took me forever to label enough inhibitory cells in LAIR-4. And one class were tuned for orientation and the other were not. And Ken had a model that even I could understand. And, you know, he had one idea about how to implement contrast invariant orientation tuning that required these sort of tuned inner neurons to be, they were tuned, but their tuning wasn't contrast invariant. And I found inner neurons that looked as well tuned at high contrasts as excitatory cells, but a class that were not tuned, that would fit a term in his model. So that was kind of nice. And I felt that, this was before I collaborated with Fritz, about working with engineers for so many years when I was a graduate student was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't feel that I had to be able to, things that were at the edge of my ability to understand, I didn't think were completely inaccessible because I'd worked with engineers. I think that was helpful. I wasn't as afraid as I might have been, and it put me in a mindset. And then,
so you were already kind of gaining a certain amount of, encouragement from models, or very early on,
yeah,
in terms of your ideas about what kinds of experiments to do.
I think that's true. But we had a paper that was hellish to get published. I remember the review saying, she just doesn't know how to record.
Oh my gosh.
A postdoc of Fritz's had an idea for and asked us to look. And
yeah, but you know, it's...
It was about oscillation.
It was about the kind of the meaning, the computational meaning of oscillations. And I mean, in the 90s, there was a very split seen in neuroscience about oscillations. There were kind of the aficionados of oscillations, and then there were other people who made their career in actually telling us oscillations are not important. And I think we were still in the late wake of this somehow, and it, you know, might have eased.
Yeah, we went to a meeting, and I think Carlos Brody was probably talking about oscillations in the olfactory system, because there was sort of, there was this idea that oscillations were the basis for consciousness, which is distasteful, right? And, for some of us. And then there were others saying, no, temporal structures and oscillations can convey information about the stimulus. And we went to a meeting, maybe it was the first cosine. It used to be this little meeting, neural information coding, and then it became cosine. Maybe it was the first cosine, something like that. I can't remember. We watched this talk, and Killian Kepsel, the postdoc at the Redwood, where Fritz is, was interested in looking at how oscillations might encode visual information. And
It was also Xin Wang who actually really saw these oscillations.
We'd seen them. Well, so, yeah, we'd seen them.
Well, these gamma oscillations in LGN relay cells, in not in every cell, but maybe in 20-30% of the cells, and they were very pronounced. And so we started to wonder, what could they be? And then Killian really performed a very good analysis and models that could really get at the core of this.
And then, I mean, you move further with that and then took that into a different zone, right, where you started to, and there'd already been some work, I thought, in retina with dynamically coupled oscillators. And
yeah, there was a lot in the 90s, and it was not in retina, it was basically in V1, and it was basically after the findings by Gray and Singer in 1989 paper. Then a lot of theorists actually started to come up with theories about what these oscillations could do in V1, but then actually it was not so conclusive to actually find them. And we kind of then built on these older models. And
I thought there was a group at Los Alamos.
Yeah, that's right, Gary Kenyon.
Yeah.
So it becomes interesting because, I mean, I think we can do hard experiments, and Fritz can read literature that is, frankly, opaque to me and distill it for me, sometimes not in the kindest words. ultimately, it's helpful. But and the students, in the best cases, the students really like it. And we had one really brilliant student, Xin Huang, who I think was able to become a master both in computation and experiments.
I mean, my interest is really to bring something really from a biological observation all the way to a computational understanding. And this is, of course, very hard, and is a long chain of things that you have, you know, what you have to do. And also, I mean, my background is physics. And in physics, actually, the collaborations between experimenters and theorists works pretty well. And it's pretty clear they really play the ball back and forth in a way which is really good. And I really tried, when I switched then from physics to neuroscience, I was fortunate to work then very early on with neuroanatomists and with people who really also try to do that, try to really work directly with experimenters to do that. And so, I mean, for me, this was always an ideal. And many of my projects, of course, not all, some part of my work is more normative theories, which are not so tightly connected to data, but a lot of, I would say the majority of my projects is involved direct collaborations with experimenters.
So as a physicist, what was sort of your interest or your entry point into neuroscience?
Yeah, so I was I was a solid state physicist, and I worked actually in hydrogen technology. And in the time when I was doing this, no one was remotely interested in this because gas was very cheap and they all just...
So this is like fuel cell type stuff?
Exactly, fuel cell. It was basically storage of hydrogen in metal granulate. And I did theory, but that was kind of the topic. But then I went to physics conferences, and this was in the 80s, and there were actually these neural net guys who talked about Hopfield networks and the theory of Hopfield networks, and that got me very excited. And then actually I switched, and my advisor was then a mathematician who actually worked with a neuroanatomist at the Max Planck Institute at the University of Tübingen with Valentin Breitenberg. And this is how I got myself into neuroscience. So my first interest was really memory. And I'm still interested. I still have projects involving memory.
And Judith, what about you? I mean, you've been a physiologist like most of your career. So what was it that drew you to the biological aspects of neuroscience, or what was it about the brain or the nervous system in general that appealed to you when you were starting out?
We've established I have no other talent, so I'll tell my favorite story. So you know Tobias Bonhoeffer. Mm-hmm. For years, David started this class in called Spring Harbor. And it's a lecture course for graduate students and postdocs. And I spoke in the same session as Tobias, and part of your job is to tell the students how you became a scientist. And Tobias got up and, you know, he said, well, you know, my uncle, this is his uncle or great uncle, was Friedrich Bonhoeffer, who was executed by the Nazis, very famous Hillary Clinton's, you know, favorite theologian, you know, and then his father was a Max Planck director, and then, you know, as a child, he was good at physics, but he was also very good at music, and it was difficult, what with this distinguished family background, Tobias, forgive me, and this wealth of talent, what to do, but ultimately he found himself as having a career in neuroscience. And then it was my turn. And, you know, I like to, you know, we don't have a long lineage of distinguished people in my family, although, I mean, we're happy to avoid incarceration, you know. We have a kind of different, collective experience as a family. And, you know, it started out in first grade. I also took piano lessons, but I was so bad that the piano teacher didn't tell me when the recital was. So she gave me 10 minutes and she gave the other girl, Midgie Goldsmith, 20 minutes, and I would practice my little piece lefty, and I was really bad. And I found out about the recital on the playground when Midgie said, Judy, why didn't you come to the recital? And that's when I found out how the recital had, you know. In acting class, right, you know, all the girls got parts. My first speaking part, my lines were arf, 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 and I was a dog, and I had a paper mache mask on my head, and I went down the school auditorium on all fours. It was 101 Dalmatians. I mean, since then I was a wave, literally. You know, not the lady military people, but a wave in Noah's Ark and Noah's Flood, and I was a fungus. I appeared on stage behind a giant snow saucer that was sprayed with trunk paint, and I was a fungus, right? So, you know, they're just eighth grade gymnastics show. All the girls had to do a stunt, but my job was to stand under the parallel bars in case someone fell.
Just to, like, break their fall.
Exactly, that was it. I was a human
pillow.
Cushion, exactly. Eighth grade Glee Club, 33 girls were asked to audition for the Glee Club out of a class of 34. So, I mean, I don't have social skills. I grew up largely in Pittsburgh, where there's a really rich fossil bed. So I spent my time digging in the dirt, looking for fossils. And I went to college, and I wanted to be a paleontologist. And then I really liked geology, but I just had this revelation later than many people might have that fossils are dead. And I... like biology. And then I'll say also there was a tragic instance in my family. My cousin was schizophrenic and he killed himself. And I felt there was enormous stigma in society about the brain as an organ and mental health. And I was thinking around that time, you know, when you're a teenager and everything is very deep and profound about doing something meaningful with my life. And I thought, you know, I took a class from a female professor. And I took a class in neuroscience, and I never thought I could do math or anything, but when she was deriving the cable equations for us, and I went and I read the Hodgkin-Huxley papers, and they were kind of accessible and pleasurable, I enjoyed that, and I thought about my cousin. And so I just sort of thought, well, I enjoy this, I like science, I'm not social. This is a field that allows you to be in a lab for a long time and maybe do something that will change the way, because when you're a teenager, you think you can change the world, right? Maybe this will, you know, be able to do something that has some kind of social meaning and benefit. you know, as you get older, you realize that these really big questions that you think maybe you'll be able to solve, you won't be able to solve in your lifetime. So you just kind of find your, you know, your place, kind of doing the work that you enjoy that is maybe tiring but gives you some energy back. And so I think I just sort of wandered into an area that let me measure things that are real. I could never be a psychologist. There's only a limit to how much imagination I think there can be.
That's fired.
So I like to be able to, systems is nice because you can fly pretty close to, right? You have data and you make real measurements, but in systems you're allowed to use your imagination a little bit and construct schemes for them that may or may not be true. So it's kind of, for me, a nice level of, you know, making, you know, observations, doing experiments that yield concrete results, and at the same time you have some space to really dream of what they might be in a larger context. And so you kind of live at that interface. But I really think it's a lack of talent. I really have not met anyone with... I got a C in typing. I mean, who gets a C in typing? And I tried. It's not like I got a C for not showing up and taking the test, you know, so...
Life beats you down enough and you become a neuroscientist.
You know, I feel there's nothing as warm and refreshing as that sickly green glow of an old Tektronix oscilloscope, you know, and so...
I actually have an appreciation for those oscilloscopes as well now, but, yeah. Maybe this is a good time,
if any,
to... Can we interview
you? Let's ask you now.
Ask me now.
I did have a question for Ben.
Oh, yes.
What was it about Judith Hirsch that made you want her to be an external member on your thesis committee? And why did you agree to do it, Judith? I guess this is the
I'm not sure why she agreed, but it was surely not for the lack of talent, I will say that.
You've since learned that you didn't know then. You know,
no. Well, first of all, there was actually two interesting aspects of why I approached Judith. One was that... the technique, the whole cell technique that I was attempting to use in my PhD, I was basing a lot of my experiments and work off of the large foundation of work that Judith had done and with Fritz. And I thought it would be really cool to have somebody who I considered to be an expert and very talented at doing a specific thing in neuroscience on my committee. But the second part was that I had heard that there were these camps in visual neuroscience, and people had dug trenches across between these camps, and that it was potentially the case that Judith was not in the camp that my advisor was in. And I thought, that'll be interesting if I put them in a room together for several hours. And I don't know, I had my first interaction with Judith. I thought she was very nice, and so I didn't really...
Little did he know.
Yeah. That's really what it was. He thought you'd be the nice committee member. Yeah.
Then as it turned out, the longer it went, the more I ended up learning about these camps, which may or may have not been dispelled. I do feel like some of them have been dispelled, but the history of these camps in visual neuroscience I got fascinated with it, I suppose.
Are there camps in visual neuroscience?
You mean like softball camps?
Yeah, exactly. Cold Spring Harbor.
I think there are, although, and I'll just say, Ben was just such an enthusiastic, productive student, you know, and I do a lot of work with our graduate program, and there aren't that many enthusiastic, productive students out there who you think are going to maybe be a scientist one day. So that's...
I'm still trying.
That's that. And, you know, we're always happy to see someone who doesn't know. There are camps. I think the main camp is I don't always, you know, yes, there are camps. I think the main difference, the main camps that there were, actually, we all have the same. I was in Torsten Wiesel's lab. I don't even know how I got there. I studied the auditory system for my thesis. So I wasn't, you know, I really wanted to move to a different system, and I had a number of reasons to choose this lab. I really wanted to
What aspect of the
New York
auditory system were you studying?
Well, I started out when I began graduate school in a man named Tom Yin's lab, who's really great, and he studied sound localization and spirit colliculus, and so I did. And I really enjoyed it. And what was nice was I'd worked in sort of systems, right, and sound localization, and then I went to work in brain slices, so it was easier to think about how the circuit should transduce the stimulus. And it was in the dorsal cochlear nucleus, which is one of the three, it's one of the three divisions of the cochlear nucleus, and so they each receive input from the auditory nerve, so you can guess at what's coming in. So I like that very much, being able to have a kind of circuit level, study something at a circuit level, in something in which one could guess at the stimuli that these circuits were processing. So that was kind of nice. And then I thought I would come back to the auditory system, but I also was, I went to school at the University of Wisconsin, where there was a huge emphasis on comparative anatomy and physiology. And I thought another sensory system would be important to understand, and vision seemed to make sense, so I chose that and went to Torsen's lab. So I would say if there's a main camp that we all talk about, it's really not differences between your advisor's advisor and myself, although there are differences. We both come from the Torsten Wiesel camp. The other camp really, and I don't think there should be such a clear division, approached vision differently, right? And that camp was, you know, those who studied spatial frequency analysis in the visual system and so on and so forth. And so I think of Bob Shapley when he worked with Christine Enroth Kugel and that team as being a different camp. They took a different approach to the visual system. And I was naive, and I still am, so I didn't realize, as Ben wisely does, that you inherit a lot of the ill will. If you work in a lab, you inherit a lot of the ill will that your advisor advertently or inadvertently caused. And I agree that it's a really good idea to build bridges, because there will always be, if not camps, there will always be divisions. Because, you know, I think we all believe what we see, and we all believe we're doing a good job, and sometimes we believe what we see, and what we see is very different from what another lab sees using nominally the same preparation. And so I think that these camps emerge, and there are controversies, and people don't always behave well. So I admire Ben for thinking that it's a good idea, one way or another, to see what's, you know, behind the other door, and to try to see if the differences that seem to be dividing people are not insurmountable, because they often are. And
maybe I can just add one comment to this problem, because I think it's a deep problem. And it's, I think, not by accident that you saw actually these camps in neuroscience. And this is just, I think if I compare this to physics, kind of people agreed what the questions are, and it was much easier to actually kind of come down to a few questions, and then theorists would produce theories and experimenters would address and test these theories. And I think in neuroscience we started out with, you know, for example, in the visual system, you can either say, okay, I mean, you know, let's analyze spatial frequencies and, you know, use the Fourier theorem, or you can use bars. I mean, you can start from different ends with artificial stimuli to get a handle what the, of course, what the visual system is doing in its natural surroundings with natural stimuli, right? And both is an approximation, and we also know that the visual system is very nonlinear, and it's also clear that you cannot just take what you have learned with, let's say, spatial frequency analysis and extrapolate it to natural stimuli. And so I think this is, for that reason, you do see this in neuroscience, and it's probably, it was a pragmatic thing to have these different schools, and it was also, it's also legitimate that people start at different ends. But I hope that we will actually converge to a neuroscience where we can actually really, you know, study these systems in their more natural domains. And, you know, now we have methods that we didn't have 30, 40, 50 years ago, and actually overcome these camps, because, of course, it's very bothersome that these camps cannot really talk to each other.
That's right. Yeah.
I think, you know, because people get, you know, I think I'd also not understood the influence of, one thing I liked a lot about Torsten was, if he was wrong about something, he wouldn't stick.
He'd switch?
He'd switch. I think he was a really good scientist. And, you know, if you came in and you said, you know, in your paper it says this, but did you really measure this? I was talking about unoriented complex cells. And he said, no, maybe we didn't. And if you came in with data, I think he had a pretty open mind. But I think it's, and this is where we differ, I think experimentalists, we invest an enormous amount of time, but I think so do theorists actually invest an enormous amount of time in their theory. And often experimentalists are, you know, want to say, well, there are just so many contingencies here. Your theory involves so many improbable assumptions that, love your theory though you might, I just can't imagine that it's ever going to be implemented biologically.
But I mean, this is, it's not about theory versus experiment. Why do we have these different camps?
I think when we talk about the emergence of camps, mm-hmm. and why I think that they may emerge, not just this particular camp, but why I think there are many reasons why I think profound disagreements emerge. But so I'm just talking about, you know, one theorist might have usually his, but sometimes her own idea, and another theorist might have another idea. I probably misspoke when I gave the biologist's view. But two theorists can have very different views, even in physics, right? And there can be camps there.
Right.
And
but I mean, you know, if at all, I think theorists in neuroscience fail even more than experimentalists right now, because what I see not really emerging in the field is that we have this interplay between theories and experimentalists in the sense that really, okay, that theorists look, okay, where are cool new results? Where can I build a theory that makes then further predictions? And then have the experimentalists really taking up these theories and putting them to the test. And I think this cycle, that kind of, you know, where you come up with a new theory, it's tested, it's refuted, which leads then to new theories, is not yet working in neuroscience. I hope we'll get to that, and I think it has also to do with the camps. Mm-hmm. So I think first we need to overcome the camps. I think we cannot overcome the camps because we have now, you know, a lot of tools in machine learning where we can describe more complicated stimuli. We develop methods how you can measure receptive fields with natural, you know, visual stimulation and stuff like that. So I think we made progress. And so hopefully this also leads really to an interplay between theory and experiment that I don't see so far, or only see very rudimentary so far.
I guess I am always more pessimistic than you are. Actually, not always, but usually. And do you agree?
I don't know. Yeah, sometimes a lot.
I think different experimentalists get different results. There's just some space in the laboratory where things happen that are very hard for theorists to understand. So I know when we talked a lot about data sharing, it's hard, you know, if you map a receptive field and your stimulus is just a little bit too big and you don't know that, you'll get a really different impression of the neuron than if your stimulus isn't too big or if your contrast is too high. Or if it's too low, or your input resistance is just, if your cell is too leaky. There are just all sorts of little things that an experimenter might not even be aware of that give a completely different answer. And it's very difficult because everyone, you know, there's...
We all want to believe the data that we spent hundreds of hours collecting, and we're all very passionate about this, and it's hard to... Yeah, all of this discussion is really a perfect segue on two levels to talking about the CR and CNS that mm-hmm. you put together about this collaborative research in computational neuroscience, so a consortium of data. And I mean, it's interesting on one hand because it seems like you're actively trying to combat the the formation of camps and make data more accessible and bring theorists closer to experimentalists. But I'm also a pessimistic person like Judith, and I find it very interesting, actually, that the experimentalists have actually, a fair number, have actually offered up their data to this and have made it open, because I personally know that that can be difficult.
Yeah, let me say a little bit about CLCNS.org. So CLCNS, it's named after actually a funding program of NSF and NIH. It's a joint funding program, and it does a little bit like this matchmaking thing. So you can only apply if you are actually, if there is a team of a theorist and an experimental.
Who've published together. I mean, that's important for getting the grant. So you've had your first child.
Right. So that's right. So it was a little bit already in the advanced stage, but it was a little bit like this. And I mean, when we started to think about these data sharing things, this was in the early 2000s, and we were deeply frustrated by actually theorists and theory papers who did not really address important questions, because they kind of operated in this data void space. They obviously didn't have access to data, and they were not as fortunate as I was to be married to an experimentalist, for example. And so we thought, that's not good. It's kind of a waste of resources, right? You have really bright people willing to think about the problem, but you don't give them the data. So it would be also in terms of really using intellectual resources in the best way. We thought it would be wonderful to have a site where you can actually share data for experimentalists who finished a project, who say, okay, I will not do much more with this data set because I'm an experimentalist. I want now to do another experiment. And we have many contributors to the CLCNS.org site who think like this, like Yuri Busaki, for example. He said, I also don't want to kind of then, get requests. How can I read out this data set that you published here? I want to load that off to a third party, basically. And this is the idea of this sharing resource that we kind of have. And it works very well in one regard, and it doesn't work so well in another regard. It works very well in the sense that a data set which is almost every data set which is shared there is heavily used. And we have tracked ourselves over the last years, more than 100 publications that use these shared data. These publications wouldn't be there without the shared data, which is great. It did not work so well in the sense that the contribution did not really scale up. And I mean, Ben uttered some doubts and said that, people might have second thoughts. And of course, Judith said this too. And I mean, okay, why is there no data set of Judith? It's also, her experiments are often of the nature that it's so rare that you get across the right cell that a lot of the cells in Judith's database sit there for 10 years until she has then really 15 other cells to actually finish the project. So, and of course, it's our understanding absolutely that data should not be shared before you are done with your project. And that is certainly one stumbling block for Judith to contribute to the to the data.
Besides my two cells that are somewhere.
And exactly, besides this small data set that you contribute. And the other thing is, and you said also, well, it's often very hard to interpret data. You see the data, but without contextual information, you don't know what's going on. And I mean, of course, I'm a physicist by training, so I really think we need to get to a state, we need to get as a field to a state where experiments are reproducible in a fashion that if there are some contextual constraints that need to be told, that they can be stored with the data. So that also, if you in your lab, you look back 5 years later into a data set that a student of you has recorded 5 years ago, you might not remember the context yourself, and you will really rely on this. And I really think this is very important, and for that reason, we actually joined forces with, this Neuro Data Without Borders project, where we really tried to come up with a data format that also is able to describe metadata that are necessary to understand actually the recording data. And that's not a finished project, but it has capabilities as I think no other format has so far, that it really can describe also the metadata. And so we hope that this can really get us into a state that some of these things that right now have to be communicated somehow by sitting together for a week, that some of this at least we can actually put into the file and actually have it accessible if you want to do something else with the data.
So is this going to be like literally a list of different items that need to be included with the data that's submitted to CRNCNS? That's say I'm submitting intracellular voltage measurements, so I need XYZ as well for the context.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And it's also it was a technical hurdle also. How some of these metadata are kind of complicated to some of them need to be really in data structures that it's kind of, you know, for example, the time axis is the same. So there are some difficulties. And of course, in neuroscience data, you have in many scientific data, but I think in neuroscience data in particular, you have this problem that every experimenter and every experiment has its own, variables one takes track of, right? So it's, for example, our poster child example for data sharing is astronomy, but it's a much simpler problem. I mean, it's also not quite as simple because there's this different, this broad spectrum. And you can do infrared astronomy, and you can do, you know, optical astronomy, and so on. And those used to be different fields, in fact. And it's very interesting that with the advent of a common data format in the late 70s, it's called the FITS format, this basically unified astronomy. So that now people can talk to each other because the sky is a somewhat easier problem because there is this one coordinate system where you can kind of then co-register every data point with. And in neuroscience, every brain is different. Every brain recording, activity recording methods has its kind of different data and comes with different additional information that you need to take track of. So our problem is the data format was you cannot just like the FITS format come up with a relational database and say, okay, these are the fields that you have to fill in and then you're done. It's impossible.
Yeah.
And it's impossible for the different recording techniques that exist. It's also impossible for all the different behavioral paradigms that people study. Right, and so we needed to come up with something that allows the detail that is required to have really reproducible data, but at the same time also to allow the flexibility to allow an experimenter to come up with a new behavioral paradigm that no one studied before, and be able to somehow adjust the data format to this new task. And so we came up with our data format basically has a formal description language that allows you to write extensions if you want to do something like this. But at the same time, if you are actually doing a standard paradigm, you can just use whatever is there already. This is the way how we try to handle this problem, that it's endless.
So it's sort of about coming up with a universal format so that people from a bunch of different walks of life in neuroscience can intersect with each other.
Right. And I mean, we have actually in our own lab a very beautiful example how actually data sharing really can kind of kickstart a project from nothing. So I had a postdoc, Gautam Agarwal, who is actually now at the Champalimaud in Lisbon. And he came to my lab and he said, okay, Fritz, I did experiments during my PhD, but I don't want to do any experiments. I want to use shared data. I said, well, that's a strange motivation, but okay. We have here this database and there's a lot of data sets that are shared there. And then we somehow thought about the problem. We thought we are both very interested in memory. And so we actually looked into a data set of Gyori Busaki. And then basically Gautam discovered that you can actually reconstruct from the spatiotemporal structure from the 10 hertz wave in the hippocampus. So not from the spikes, only from the 10 hertz wave in the hippocampus.
You mean the LFP?
The local field potential. If you record it at different locations in the in region CE1, for example, so you put a multi-electrode array into CE1, you record from, let's say, 28 or 64 channels, and you filter away everything which is not in the 10 hertz band, mm-hmm. and you will see actually a traveling wave rolling through the CA1 region if the rat is navigating. If you look more closely, you will see that there are phase distortions that actually differ in different locations of the hippocampus. And these phase distortion patterns are specific to a single location of the hippocampus. So in other words, you can decode from the 10 hertz wave in the hippocampus exactly where the rat is at every point in time with the same precision as if you would decode the spikes that you record wow. from the same electrodes. And so Gautam got kind of the preliminary finding, and then Gyuri was very excited about it, and we started the direct collaboration. And mm-hmm. so, you know, we got a beautiful study and paper out of this, what all basically started with a shared data set, which was accessible to everyone here on the planet, mm-hmm. basically.
That's good. I mean, that's sort of the dream. That's the dream way for things to work. I mean, personally, I can attest that things have, we've personally contributed a fair amount of data to the thin sort of end.
You and Nick.
Nick, yeah. Yes. Right. Some spiking data and calcium imaging data. And I was actually very surprised to find it was being used in papers. Actually, like one popped up this year. But this is actually where the interesting point really came from, and it's sort of related to this story, is that I had no idea. I actually just saw this paper, and then it was like data from the, that was freely available, recorded by Benchel or whatever. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I had no idea these people were even doing this. And so on some level, I'm like, this is great. I'm really excited that other people are using this data that actually I considered somewhat archaic and whatnot. But like in this case specifically, I can see how you might have a problem. So where Busaki could have said, he could have been a little bit angry that he missed such an important thing in his own data. Or you could have been in a situation where, I mean, you guys obviously are very nice and collaborative people to work for, but you can imagine that other people may find such a strong result in their data and may want to squirrel it away and save all the glory for themselves. So there's not really an incentive in many cases for...
This came up in the early meetings. You should say that you shared senior authorship with Yuri on this paper. And I definitely kind of was in the camp, if you give someone a mouse, you're an author on the paper. And I feel that the group who published your data set could have been a little bit more gracious, because I really do think that it would have been the right thing to do, frankly, to communicate with the group who collected the data. Ask them, tell them about the project, frankly, and then offer authorship. Because if the contribution is large enough to merit authorship, and I think that was one of the issues that came up in the early meetings, and I think this is an example of that not being solved. I gave my data to someone to collaborate, I was collaborating with, and he gave them to someone else who was well known and called me to say, I hope you don't mind, we published it. And I also had that feeling, it is just... This wasn't even shared data. This was...
I felt that
was not flattering.
I guess I'm bringing up this point because...
I think it's a valid one.
Yeah. Well, also, personally, I'm not in a camp. I'm still trying. So
I just don't know it.
Yeah, exactly. I just don't know.
Maybe calling at this moment to your own camp.
Yeah. I guess my camp is that... I'm happy for both cases, or I'm happy that I mean, yes, maybe it would be nice if somebody were to use data that I collected in the future and contact me about it and at least say, hey, we're using this. It's really great, you know. But on the other hand, I kind of agree with Fritz. I just the fact that they want to use the data at all and they're pulling it from this database and that they consider it high of quality enough to do the analysis that they want to do, and that I have like contributed. That my work has contributed in a different way to this scientific community, to the neuroscience community, and on some levels that gives me a nice feeling, I guess.
I think it's a nice feeling. I guess that there's a practical constraint, that when you get your first job and you're going up for tenure, and your dossier is being prepared, and the number of publications with your name on them are being counted and quantified and compared with your cohort. Those are the real world constraints when you're applying for grants and so on and so forth, that it would be nice, you know what I mean? I think one of the ideas is it would be nice for all of this work that you've done then to come back and help you out a bit. And I think that's why people are concerned, because there are consequences, survival, that sort of thing, that may depend on this kind of recognition.
So, I mean, yes, this was, of course, discussed a lot when we started. And, I mean, there is a problem with acknowledgement right now. I absolutely agree with that. I mean, you know, in the case of our collaboration with Curie, it was really that he was very directly involved then in this paper. We had regular Skype conferences. It was really... I mean, the regulation at clcns.org right now is that every data contributor can specify basically the conditions under which the data is shared. So you could, a contributor potentially could say, I want co-authorship. But we don't see this happen very much. And of course, it's also not enforceable, because this is also almost ridiculous that there is no copyright on scientific data. You know, if you write a text, there's copyright. If you draw an image, there's copyright. If you spend years of your life in a dark basement and collect data, there's no copyright. It's not legally enforceable, but of course, I mean, you can specify, as data contributor, you can specify the conditions under which you share. And usually what most contributors choose is that they say, okay, please cite our original paper so that it gets more citations. And I absolutely also agree there is then a credit assignment problem. But I think we have also to work within the field towards that there is more recognition if someone actually shares data and you're not a co-author, but you put up your data and it's used by other papers, that you get credit in your CV for that. And yeah. I think we have to work towards that. I think that would be the right thing to do. Because, I mean, yeah, you probably don't want to be a co-author on any publication that somehow uses your data.
That's also true.
You might not agree with what they do with it. And then, you know, but we then also, I mean, this was also a concern that people said, woo, if someone does something with my data where I disagree. But we then also said, okay, if someone publishes this, it goes through a review process. And it somehow should sort itself out. We have to believe in that. Otherwise, we do not believe in the review process in general, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we did not see huge problems in that regard. We never really found very upset contributors of data who said, my God, there's... I mean, some people said, well, someone used the paper, used my data in the paper, and I don't think it's a big contribution. But we did not see so-called abuse of the data.
Well, sometimes it doesn't have to be abuse. It's just, a different point of view.
but I mean, that's then fine. You're not a co-author of this paper, right? I mean, you can use this to write your response in another paper if you disagree with that. And that's a discourse in science that is important.
Right? Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I am more pragmatic sometimes. Because you are a theorist.
Well, on that note, I mean, I think we have a good understanding of
our marriage,
a working scientific collaboration, how camps are formed, how the future of data sharing might help surmount some of these
things.
We
didn't get to interview you.
There's nothing to find out.
It's really? You just actually are just a projection?
Yeah, exactly.
You're ectoplasm?
Yeah, I'm a figment. I'm just a ball of questions. But we'd love to thank both of you for joining us today. This is really great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you would like to listen to more episodes of Max Planck Florida Institute's Neurotransmissions podcast, listen in on iTunes or SoundCloud. And to keep up to date, follow us on Facebook and Twitter at @neuropodcast.
Listeners, if you like MPFI's Neurotransmissions, you do not want to miss the chance to join us live for Sunposium. It's happening March 4th through 6th in beautiful West Palm Beach, Florida. This is a two-day conference. It brings the best minds in neuroscience. We're going to have poster sessions. We're going to have great talks. And if you want, you could even meet us, the podcast team. We are now accepting abstracts. And if we really like your abstract, you will have the opportunity to speak at Sunposium along with the greats. So learn more at sunposium.org. So that's SUNPOSIUM.org.